300 sensors, over a million data points per second. How does F1 update their fans with every stat in real time? AWS is how. From fastest laps to strategy calls, AWS puts fans in the pit. It's not just racing, it's data-driven innovation at 200 miles per hour. AWS is how leading businesses power next-level innovation.
You make a decision, for example, and you send people in harm's way and it doesn't work out. The problem is you can't then go into a fetal position in the corner and sob and feel sorry for yourself because you made a decision and it didn't work out. That's not what the organization needs. It's important that the leader knows that's what they're there for. If they're not willing and able to make those decisions, they need to leave that position.
Hey everyone, I'm Dan Bova from Entrepreneur.com and welcome to How Success Happens, the show where I talk to extraordinary people who have been put in extraordinary situations. Today's guest is retired General Stanley McChrystal. He led the Joint Special Operations Command in Iraq from 2003 to 2008 and spearheaded the elimination of al-Zarqawi, the leader of the terrorist organization al-Qaeda. His leadership style has been praised for creating, quote, a force of unprecedented agility and lethality. And since retiring, General McChrystal has written several best-selling books, and these days he works with business leaders to help them unlock their team's full potential. And now he has a class on Masterclass that any of us can watch and apply his leadership lessons to whatever sphere we happen to be working in. Welcome, General McChrystal.
Well, Dan, please call me Stan, and thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure.
It's an honor to talk to you, and I just want to say, you know, thank you for your decades of service.
Well, you're kind.
Wait till we get to these questions before you say that. I want to first ask, was being in the military ever a question to you? Was this always the thing you were going to do no matter what, or did you ever have different thoughts?
Yeah, I never really did. My father was a soldier and his father before him. And so from my earliest memory, I wanted to be my father. And because he was a soldier, I wanted to be a soldier, which it was interesting. A few years ago, I gave a talk at a junior high school and a young girl asked me that question. And I said, nope, I just wanted to that. And she goes, that doesn't seem very smart. That was a fair point, but it ended up working out for me.
It did. Is there anything you could imagine? I mean, obviously business, we've seen post-military career, but anything, race car driver, fire engine, whatever, anything like that?
No, it's funny. I've been able to see a lot of other professions since then. I don't think I would have liked any more than being a soldier, but there are things like, interestingly enough, being a farmer. I find that as the same kind of a challenge as you're building something, making it work. You got to be effective. You got to be efficient. I mean, it's all those kinds of things. Now, I know nothing about farming, so I wouldn't do very well, but that intrigues me.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's always a next act. So who knows what happens. So when you were in the military, how did you define success? And how is that the same or how completely different is it from how you define success in the business world?
Yeah.
As we've seen on this show, all kinds of people can find success. Did you know that 34% of tech professionals don't have a bachelor's degree? Skills First Hiring isn't just inclusive, it is the smart strategy to expand your tech talent pipeline. And finding the right tech talent isn't just hard, it's mission critical. And yet many enterprise employers still rely on outdated methods or platforms that just don't deliver. In today's market, hiring tech professionals isn't just about filling roles, it's about outpacing competitors. But with niche skills, hybrid preferences, and high salary expectations, it's never been more challenging to cut through the noise and connect with the right people. And that's where Indeed comes in. Indeed isn't just a job board, it is your tech hiring partner. As a number one site where tech talent applies to jobs, Indeed gives you direct access to over 3 million U.S. tech professionals, 86% of whom have applied through the platform. So post your first job and get $75 off at Indeed.com/tech talent. That's Indeed.com/tech talent to claim this offer. Indeed, built for what's now and what's next in tech hiring.
In June 2024, a teenager attended a music festival and never returned.
Miles and miles away from where he was staying, up a mountain.
He wasn't gone 3 days and turned into Pablo Escobar.
The online sleuths had lost sight of this was somebody's son.
The Disappearance of Jay Slater on Channel 4. Stream now.
It's funny. Most of the time in the military, the Army's at peace. And so what you are doing is you are training people, you are building an organization, you're training values, you're doing all the things that are really important long term. When you get into combat, then it's like being in business with a profit and loss where you've got to perform on a basis that's, you know, obviously life or death. They are related, but they are slightly different. So you have to take a long-term view when you are in that period in peacetime. And in wartime, you've got to take a shorter-term view, but not forget the long-term. Because at the end of the day, you're also having to build the institution for the future. So I found that transition from long to short, have to get it done right now, to be an interesting challenge.
I watched your masterclass, you said that your job as commander of JSOC wasn't making decisions. It was leading people who could make decisions. Could you dive into that a little bit?
Yeah, thanks for bringing it up, because the masterclass is a great opportunity. It's like writing a book. You are forced to put your ideas into focus and to really pressure test them so that you can communicate them in some value. And so I think that whole masterclass process is so good. I found that you get to be a senior leader, you grow up operating. You grow up, you know, doing whatever you do, and you naturally want to do that because that's your comfort zone. But that's not your value add to the organization. Your value add is to create an environment in which the people that work with you and for you can be as effective as possible. Part of that is creating systems, processes, expectations that they operate within. Part of it is developing them as individuals. Part of it's building their confidence, providing a measure of inspiration. You know, you've got to be an organization that they want to be a part of and a leader that they want to follow. And if you're not those two, it makes it really hard for your subordinates.
So how do you go about getting the best out of people by pushing them, but not pushing them so much that they're rebel against you or want to avoid you, or, you know, all those other things that happens when leadership kind of maybe, I don't know if oversteps is the right word, but pushes people away.
Yeah, Dan, this is art, you know, that not science, but I'll describe what I think works the best. The first is you've got to have a set of values that you run your organization with that people are comfortable with. They have to believe that they're doing something of value and something that's in line with their moral and other beliefs. The second thing is, as a leader, you've got to be somebody that they respect. If you are somebody that they hold in contempt, even if you've got a great mission and you're part of a good organization, you will have a difficult time connecting them because they may do what you direct them to do, but they often won't do any more than that.
Yeah.
And so this is where leadership by example, and it's not what you say in this case, they watch what you do. So you can make pronouncements, but how you behave, what you do with consistency and how you interact with people over time, when the very difficult decisions come, how did you come down? Did you make them in a way that's aligned with the values that you'd been espousing? Then I do think you have to push an organization, but you push them best by pulling them. You get in front of the organization, you exhibit all of the things, the level of effort you want them to exhibit. If you work, you want them to work hard, it's necessary that you work hard. If it requires them undergoing a certain amount of privation or danger, you've got to be willing to overtly share that same privation or danger. Because even though their job may be harder than yours, because a young sergeant in combat's doing more than a general for sure, but they want to believe that the general is doing what they can to show that they respect what the team is doing and to pull it along.
I love this concept that you also talk about, commander's intent. You know, giving people the big picture. You know, sometimes I imagine in combat you can't give the really, really, really big picture because you'd be there for days and weeks explaining everything. But can you talk about that concept and how that might relate to a business?
The idea of commander's intent is not new, but it's not been uniformly exercised by militaries. It was designed that you have an order that goes out, an operations order, and it says who, what, when, where, why, and how. It's very specific of this is the time you do the operation, who's going to do it, and that. But then the commander personally writes a paragraph or more that in their own words says, okay, this is what we're trying to do. If everything goes badly, just remember we are trying to take this hill. We're willing to accept this amount of risk to do it. We want to do end with these particular conditions. So it sort of goes to the idea that if everything goes into disarray, remember we're out here to drain the swamp or whatever the actual task is. And it turns out to be a very effective way to allow a leader to first get their own mind clear. What is it I'm asking the unit to do? Mm-hmm. What am I asking my people to accomplish? And you can put it in your own words that they can go, okay, I got it. And I used to tell people that if we send you an order that based on the conditions of where you are is wrong, don't execute that order. Execute the order we should have given you, based upon what we're trying to accomplish. And we trust your judgment to figure out what that would be.
That's fantastic. And how do you, as a leader, build that trust, not just trust for you, but I have to trust these people to do these things. How do you train yourself to trust people when you're used to kind of doing so much yourself?
Yeah, you have to give trust and build it over time. I often ask people who they trust, and they tell me their teachers, or they tell me their pastor, or their family. And I tell them they trust McDonald's. And they might say, well, I don't prefer that food. And you go, it doesn't matter. Over decades, they've shown us that when you see the sign, you know what it costs, you know what the products are, you know the relative quality. So you can make an informed decision on whether you want to eat there.
Right.
You can trust that message that they're sending you. As a leader, you've got to build the same trust. And then as you develop trust in your people, you've got to give them the opportunity to execute, because I can't trust you're going to do something if I never test that.
Right.
If I never give you the opportunity to fulfill a request, how do I know if you can do it? Because you've got to show me that you are first capable of doing what I ask you to do, and second, that you are willing to genuinely try to do it. And the problem is you can be genuinely willing, but incapable.
Right.
And so you've got to build that over time. And so I always tell people, trust is something we grow, and we've got to grow it and nurture it.
Yeah, absolutely. So on this show, we talk to people in all kinds of spheres, people in business, people in entertainment. And there's this overarching theme of risk-taking, taking calculated risks. Now, the kind of risks that I've talked about involve money, involve maybe appearing in a show that doesn't do that well. The kind of risks that you've been involved with, the stakes are a lot higher. And I wonder for maybe younger listeners, If you can kind of explain the situation in Iraq that you were commanding over, and some of those decisions you had to make, you know, as I mentioned at the top, al-Zarqawi, you know, you had to make some split-second decisions to accomplish that mission. Can you talk us through that a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. First, every mission potentially is life or death, and so they have to be considered in that light. But there's a tendency to then want to pull them up to the highest level because you want to centralize them because it's life or death. But the reality is that's not where the decision is best made in most cases. In the special operations world, when I took command, I was personally approving every operation because we weren't doing a lot. We were doing about 4 a month. Within 2 years, we had increased to 300 a month, from 1 a week to 10 every night. And about 30% of those were failing. And when you talk, even successful missions also often carry a cost. So every operation is important from a risk standpoint, plus important to accomplishing the mission. So, but you can't try to centralize them all because you're the wisest and you're the person in charge. You've got to push the decision down to the level where people are most informed and they understand best what's likely to accomplish the operation. We traditionally, in pyramid-shaped organizations, we pass down instructions, we say, do this, and then the idea is all those tasks will be assembled together and everything will end up perfect. You can't do that now. You've got to push that understanding down. So when they make a decision, it's within that context of, I know what we're trying to do. I understand the commander's intent. Then you've got to communicate that, yes, there is risk in everything we do. And a percentage of the time, it won't work out. Simply because you don't get a good outcome does not mean it's a bad decision. Mm. You can make the best decision, but probability is such that sometimes the enemy does better than you do, or random things happen. And so if you hold people to this idea that every decision must be successful for you to make it, what the organization does is it seizes up. Mm. Because people want to drive the risk of failure to zero, so they look for perfect information, perfect conditions, and they'll only do things with almost no risk of failure. Mm. And so what we had to do was push down to the organization that says, we expect failure. We accept failure. We're not looking to fail, and we expect you to be diligent in your preparation and responsible in your decision-making. But if you're not failing a reasonable percentage of the time, you're not doing enough. You're not pushing hard enough. You're not taking advantage of enough opportunities. And communicating that across an organization is challenging because there's a natural reluctance, particularly midway in the organization. And you've got to find a way to get your message down because this is a cultural shift more than an order. And we found that radical transparency, talking about it, talking about successes and failures very openly in the command was necessary to give people the confidence to make decisions.
Now, I'm not going to discount like the pressures that an entrepreneur might be under, but when you talk about failure, it could be a failing business, but it could also be like a marketing plan didn't work out and we spent a little too much on Facebook than we should have. But, you know, the results of some of what you're talking about is the loss of life. And how, as a commander, you know, do you train yourself to kind of accept what bad things might happen and also stay energized and not become overly fearful?
Yeah. You're right. In business, sometimes some decisions seem life or death. And then in the rearview mirror, they appear pretty trivial. We're worrying about something. In combat, first off, you do have an advantage. Everybody out there knows the nature of decisions that leaders are making. So it's understood that if you make a decision to commit people in certain situations, there's a high probability that some will be killed or badly wounded. So people do go in with that understanding, and that's helpful. For the leader, it's quite possible that you can get yourself almost stunned into an action. You make a decision, for example, and you send people in harm's way and it doesn't work out. And sometimes it turns out that it was a stupid decision. And I made some and it's exactly what happened. The problem is you can't then go into a fetal position in the corner and sob and feel sorry for yourself because you made a decision and it didn't work out. That's not what the organization needs. Mm. What the organization needs you to do is go, my job is to make decisions facing forward. I should learn from the decisions that didn't work. I should pay attention to that. But I need to make decisions facing forward. And sometimes it is going to be very, very painful when I don't get the outcome that I want. Sometimes it's embarrassing. Sometimes, you know, put any name you want on it. But it's important that the leader knows that's what they're there for. If they're not willing and able to make those decisions, they need to leave that position.
Do you have any, or did you have any kind of mantras or anything that goes through your head when you are in these kinds of situations? Anything that you remind yourself, any saying or anything someone has advised you that sort of helped you stay focused?
Not really. I kept telling people that, remember, I kept telling people we are in a war. And in a war, one side wins and one side loses. And it's not decided yet how this particular war is going to come out. And if you respond, if you give people that context, because they tend to get in the context of the mission they're in and the danger and whatnot, and you say, we are here to accomplish a mission. That's the purpose. We wouldn't be here if we didn't have something that the nation decided needed to be done. And that, at the end of the day, has to be the guidepost.
Is there, your career is so long with so many accomplishments. Is there anything that really serves as a proud moment for you? Anything that really stands out as something that you look back on with great pride that you are a part of?
Yeah, there are a number of things when I was parts of teams that did things that made me feel really good. I'll go back to Iraq, very difficult time in 2004, 5, and 2006, and for an extended period. And I'm part of the counterterrorist force at that point. There was essentially the same people in combat over and over and over for years. And when we talk about that, there were operators that did 2,000 or 3,000 raids themselves. Wow. And if you think about that, that's just an extraordinary amount of highly lethal combat. And they kept able to operate based upon certain things. The first was they did believe in our cause. Mm. They believed that what we were doing was right. The second is they believed in their teammates.
Yeah.
And they believed that their teammates would take care of them, and they felt responsible to take care of their teammates. And so you don't feel alone. No matter how difficult it gets, how frightening it gets, if you feel alone, I think that that's the most challenging thing you can have in life. Teams like that, the cohesion became the combat multiplier.
We get questions from viewers, and this question is kind of like the other side of what we've been talking about a bit. It comes from Robert C. and says, what do you advise people to do when they've lost faith in leadership and they're being told to do something they kind of know will be a disaster? What do you advise to someone in that role?
Yeah, that may be the hardest situation any of us find ourselves in, because it is really hard for someone down in an organization to change the behavior of senior leaders. I do think you can make your views known. Sometimes they're welcomed and listened to, sometimes they are not. And that creates a real dynamic of challenge. Here's what I think you don't do. You don't become passive aggressive in your resistance to what you're asked to do. If you're asked to do something or directed to do something and you don't intend to do it with your full energy and loyalty, you need to raise your hand and say, I can't or won't do that for whatever reason, because it's unfair to the organization and to the people you lead for you to half step, because that's actually more dangerous, because the mission won't fail and that there's still danger there. I think that if it is a just a disagreement on whether the company should do X or Y, and you're down in the organization, I don't think that's a reason to automatically resign from the organization or do that, because, you know, that's the way leadership works. People in the seat get to make those decisions. I think that's true of whether you're in the government or commercial or wherever. But I think that if it crosses a line where you think that what's going is wrong, maybe morally wrong or legally wrong or something like that, I think it's a mistake not to stop what you're doing. You will regret it if you're a part of something that doesn't feel like it's right to you. And again, there's a difference between just a decision that's a policy thing and something that's moral or legal.
Yeah. That's great. Great answer. Is there, well, I want to encourage everyone to watch the, subscribe for the masterclass, because it's amazing. Just some incredible things there. Is there anything that you feel like really resonates with leaders that you speak with, and anyone listening to the show, like maybe a little bit of homework, something that they could do after listening to this that they maybe try tomorrow, you know, or later today to kind of like take their leadership to the next level?
Yeah, the one I'm focused on right now is decision making, because we always complain about decision making. The decision made wasn't a right one, or it wasn't implemented effectively or aggressively, that sort of thing. And I think most organizations, to include the military, struggle with this. So the first thing I'd say is understand what decisions have to be made. Do a little thinking about that. What do we really have to make, and when do we need to make the decision so we have time to implement it? And then the next thing is, who ought to be making this decision? Sometimes we think up at the higher headquarters, if the issue rises to that level, we'll automatically make the decision there because we're smart people and get paid a lot of money. But in reality, you say somebody way down closer to the problem may have a much better perspective on how this decision ought to be made. So the second thing is you look at who ought to be making the decision where. And then as it goes time to execute, how are you going to communicate that decision? Because sometimes decisions gets made and not enough people hear about it, and so they're not really following it. But if you can communicate a decision out to everybody and say, this is made, we are no longer in the debate phase, we are now in the execute phase, that clarity, even if people didn't agree with exactly what the decision is, people crave that clarity. Okay, I know where we're going, I know what's expected, let's do it.
Yeah. That's fantastic. You know, we live in a time that feels particularly divisive. I don't know, over the course of your career, if it feels more divisive or if it's just that we forget how divisive things were and here we are again. How do you feel about efforts to bring people with very different ideas of what's right and wrong together and find some common ground?
Yeah. I lived through the 1960s. I was, you know, in junior high school and high school then. So it was a tumultuous time, but this feels far worse to me. Mm. Because we had disagreements over race. We had disagreements over the Vietnam War and some other things. But now we are having disagreements on basic values of other people. And that, to me, is concerning in a very serious way.
Yeah.
And what I think has happened is many people have found that they are incentivized to be more extreme, to be more outspoken, more negative, you know, more hateful, more unaccepting of other people's perspectives and positions, more offensive because it sells well, it does well on social media, and so on. Ultimately, that has to end in one of two ways. It either ends in some cataclysmic, very negative outcome, like conflict in the violent conflict, or everybody steps back, takes a deep breath and say, you know, we're all in this boat. And we got to stop rocking and we got to make it work. And I think the latter is obviously where we need to go. But right now, the incentives aren't there. If I go on TV and tell everybody, okay, we gotta be reasonable and talk. Everybody goes, that's nice, and they kind of fall asleep. If I go in and I say, so-and-so is an evil fascist this, people will pay attention, even though they may be completely wrong.
Right, right. I spoke to Ken Burns a while back, and he said he was talking about social media, and he said Mark Zuckerberg should be in jail. I don't know. Do your feelings on social media? What do you think about how that's kind of fueled this divisiveness?
I think social media is more powerful than we are prepared as a society to manage it. Mm-hmm. It's almost like being given kryptonite, and we didn't really understand it. And so we're just jumped into social media, and we use it very aggressively, and we are doing horrific things, particularly to children. But we're also causing all of us to be gun shy. We don't want to get out publicly because we'll get dogpiled on social media for something we say. And so I think social media is far more powerful than we ever envisioned it would be, and far more negatively leveraged than I think most of us foresaw would happen. We've got to do something about it. We got to do something very quickly. I'd like to believe that society will mature and deal with it, but it may be too hard. That may be too hard an ask. We may need to do something that feels very uncomfortable to curb the incredible power of social media.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. Well, General, we're going to lighten the mood a little bit with a little speed round here. We're asking a couple of rapid-fire questions. The first being, in your estimation, what's the best war movie ever made?
Wow. My favorite is probably The Longest Day, The Invasion of Normandy, because I saw it when I was a kid. And it's one of those things that reinforced my desire to be a soldier.
Mm. Great. And do you have a favorite rom-com?
Wow. It's funny. I really got into romantic comedies at a point because I just didn't want to. I liked You've Got Mail. Now, that's a little bit dated, but the Tom Hanks period, Meg Ryan, I fall for those.
Yeah, that's great. Well, maybe in keeping with that, how do you, you're asked a lot of heavy questions. You've dealt with a lot of heavy things over your life. How do you turn your brain off at night? How do you relax?
I read. And my wife and I both like to read. And so we sit in these two chairs in our living room and we read. And about every 20 minutes, we make a comment to one another. But it's just, it allows us to decompress.
Right.
You can almost feel it.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I do is my granddaughters live next door to me.
Ah.
And whenever I hang out with my granddaughters, it's amusing, it's challenging, and to me, it pulls you away from all the other stuff in life that seems so important.
That's fantastic. I love that. What's your morning routine? Are you still like getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning or what?
Yeah, I get up very early because that's the time I control. Mm. You know, nobody calls me or writes me at that time, and I work out every morning because that's how I also set myself physically, but also mentally for the day. Once I've worked out really hard, then everything else feels a little bit easier.
Yeah.
Now, I do get up early, but I go to bed early too.
Okay.
So, you know, people tell me about stuff that happens after 9 o'clock at night, and I say, nothing after nine interests me.
That's great. Speaking of working out, what's one aspect of basic training you're grateful to never have to do ever again?
You're familiar with burpees where, you know, I just despise them. And every time I'm at something and people go, we're going to do burpees, I want to get away.
It's been so amazing talking to you. And as I said at the top, again, thank you for your years of dedication to our country and keeping us all safe. And I would encourage everyone to check out the masterclass as well as your books, Team of Teams. What is the best way for people to kind of keep up with what you're doing, what you're thinking?
Yeah, I'm part of a company that we founded 15 years ago, McChrystal Group, and McChrystalGroup.com. We've got information on what we do, what we're learning. We put out a lot of lessons. We do a lot of leadership work with companies and transformational. And it's just, to me, it's interesting stuff. And I think people would find the same.
Fantastic. All right. Well, thank you so much. Again, really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Dan.